interdependent ecosystem. Please come in. Don't stand outside. Because of our interdependence and globalization and rising population, welfare for the whole human race depends on the health of our ecosystem. So even if you don't have any particular investments in the world, if you don't think of it as a living being, still need to be concerned about environmental issues. And here, people who are interested in social justice and people who are interested in environment can cooperate.
Isn't there a self-interest argument and not a justice argument?
Well, it can be either. We can talk about the continuation of the human race. Don't we want the human race to continue? If we do, of course we must care for the environment. Or we can talk about justice issues. Because when there's an environmental crisis, more and more, who suffers?
The poor.
The poor. For instance, famine used to be an issue of geography. If you lived in Ireland and there was a potato blight, the Irish, mostly the poor, but the whole country suffered, right? Nowadays, if there's a drought or a crop failure, people high up, you know, people with high incomes have enough to eat. Their incomes aren't radically disrupted. The people who suffer are those who are poor, either because food prices rise or because the food they grow is sold off somewhere else. And we've been learning about that in a number of venues this week, not only this one. I think the Ekblads have been talking about some of those issues a bit themselves, and I'll bring that up again later. So there, it can be an entirely species-centered interest, right? We want to perpetuate ourselves. Or it can be a social justice interest. We want to treat our brothers and sisters in the world in a fair way. And if we're going to do that, we need to correct. We need to distribute environmental costs and the benefits of our agriculture and our mining and all of those things equally. Okay, so there's a distribution issue here. If we want everyone to have good quality of life, we need to cut. We can't put pollution only where those other people are. We need to just get rid of it, right? So those are justice issues. We're probably aware of most of the problems that we're facing. Fittingly enough, before this session, I spent the morning on the garbology team, so all these things were brought home to me again. One of our major issues, of course, is global warming. We're going to have a temperature rise of several degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels by the early part of the next century, and maybe even more than several degrees by the middle part of next century. Now, the result of this is not only rising sea levels, but climate changes that are likely to desertify much of our agricultural land. Given that there are so many regions of the world in which it's almost too dry to grow crops anyway, okay, this is a huge problem. I think it would have an effect in Asia, including South Asia. Certainly China would be drastically affected, and that would be a big problem because they don't irrigate a lot. So we have global warming, which would have a disastrous effect on agriculture. Then we have water table problems. Okay? Many countries in the world are now irrigating. Well, this is good. They've increased their crop yields. Well, maybe not. In India, in the Gujarat area, water tables are dropping by a meter and a half a year. That's 5 feet. Okay? Aquifer depletion is happening 5 feet per year. That means they're using much more water out of the aquifer than can be replaced by rain every year. This can't go on for very long. And as soon as the aquifers dry up, irrigation dries up, and crop yields in India plummet. Okay? We have water table problems of our own in our irrigated areas of the Midwest, especially. We have dropping water tables, and so we are living on borrowed time as far as irrigation goes. And we're going to have lowered yields because of that. And if we have runaway global warming, the effect will be even more drastic, because not only will we not have water to irrigate with, but we'll have less rain than we used to. So this is a problem. Food is one of the main issues here. And I have a few. I can get these to show up clearly. They may be a little bit small, but I want to give you a sense of what we're talking about. This is per capita grain use. By the way, some of these figures that I'm using today come out of an annual book that's put out called The State of the World. This one's 1999. And it's a series of articles on the state of our world economically, demographically, environmentally, so that we can keep up tabs on it. Different sorts of emphases every year. And it's really worth looking at. I recommend getting it if you're interested in reading about the ways that we're demographic figures globally for explaining the ways that we're living now and the ways that income, food, land, etc. are distributed. Very helpful eco-justice resource. Okay, if you look at annual per capita grain use and consumption of livestock products, this is just last year, we noticed something fairly alarming. In the United States, our grain use per person in kilograms is 900 kilograms, okay? If you want to know pounds, multiply that by 2.2 and you get close to a ton of grain per person. Now, how many of you eat a ton of grain per year? Anybody?
Apparently, we all do.
Well, we don't directly. But how do you suppose we each account for a ton of grain per year?
Animal feed.
Meat. Okay? If you've got a steer in a feedlot and you're fattening it up right before it's butchered, guess how many kilos of grain per pound of added weight you need to use?
Seven to one.
Okay? Pork is 4, poultry is around 2. Okay, fish farming is a little bit under that. Now you can see how it is we eat so much grain, because look, 44 pounds of beef, right, per year per person, average. I know all of us don't eat that much, okay? Pork is 31, poultry 47, mutton we're not too big on. Milk, lots of milk, all right? Even those among us who like to cut down on our meat consumption often substitute cheese. Okay, we get a lot there, and lots of eggs. Compare that with Italy, 400 pounds. And we all know the Italian diet relies a lot on grains. So it's not the difference in grain consumption, but simply the difference in meat and milk usage. Okay? China, much, much lower. Okay? And India, only 200 kilos per person. Now, the average person in India does not get enough nutrition. So we shouldn't consider this the model. But somewhere in the Italy and China range is actually the area in which we're healthiest. Ironically enough, eating too much food and eating too little food cause the same kinds of problems. Susceptibility to disease, early morbidity, etc. Okay? So eating at the average US level is as unhealthy as eating not enough. Ideally, we'd be somewhere around in here. But if we realize that we are each taking up 4.5 times as much space for grain as the average Indian person, that's an extreme amount. And that doesn't count how much space it takes for rangeland. Okay? How much space are those cattle taking up? You know, that's another additional bit of land. One of the most arresting images I have from this week is hearing Bob Ekblad and Stelio and Angel David and Rocio talk about land use in Honduras. Okay. There was a marvelous slide, beautiful, flat, fertile grassland being grazed by cattle. All of that nice, flat, fertile grassland is owned by a few rich people who graze their cattle on it, and sell it either to people in Honduras or export it to people like us. Okay? And where is the farming done? Hillsides. Okay? Hillsides are difficult to farm, first of all, because the topsoil layer tends to be thin. Secondly, because it's very difficult to keep it from eroding. And if you're not trying to farm an already arable hillside that probably isn't properly terraced, you're probably doing slash and burn farming. The soil there is very weak. It erodes extremely quickly once you get the trees off it, and so you exhaust the soil very quickly. Well, wouldn't it make a lot more sense to redistribute that land, right? So that people are farming on the flat land. Amazing idea. And yet, because there's demand for beef, right, the land is distributed in this way and causes environmental degradation, as well as making it impossible for people to grow basic food crops. Another big product is sugarcane. Think about that when you eat your oatmeal. People, poor peasants in Honduras, are growing sugarcane to export and often then don't have beans. Okay? They could grow beans, but they can make money on the sugarcane. So we need to change the demand side of the equation. We really need to change the demand side of the equation in order to change the way that agriculture is done and to change the amount of space that each one of us takes up agriculturally. This doesn't even count, okay? This doesn't even count vegetables, soybeans, all that stuff. That's just grain. Interestingly enough, the cultivated, the grain space, the amount of cultivated grain per person in the world is about 0.13 hectares per person, okay? However, we cover more than that space with the amount that we eat, okay? For instance, this is if we ate only wheat, and we don't. But if we ate only wheat and we were considering U.S. yield levels per hectare, we would take up 3 times the world average in space, okay, for our grain. So we need to realize we're using more than our fair share, okay? The other thing we need to know is that the U.S. provides half of the world's grain exports. We provide 100 million tons of grain exports per year. And if we grow at the fairly modest projected levels, our own country, by 50 years from now, we will need every single kilo of those, okay, exports. And so that means that the demand of the world for grain will be growing, and because our grain production can only grow at a rate of about 1% a year, we will soon be needing all of that grain. We will not be able to export to anybody at all.
Shouldn't that cause alarm to the rest of the world that depends on our grain exports?
It should cause alarm to the rest of the world, but it should cause alarm to us because after 2050 we'll be low. Now, of course, if we start using less grain, we'll be okay.
We've
this is projecting at current use levels.
We've got a huge amount of slack in our dietary patterns to accommodate, you know.
Right. Suppose we came down to 350 or 400, see, we would still be exporting. But if we continue at our current levels, we won't. What's the next thing you have in here? Oh, okay, this is cultivated.
You're sort of implying that it's somehow the responsibility of the United States, people in the United States, to do something about this in advance. Is that sort of the implication of what you're saying?
Well, I'm talking to Americans. But you're right, it's a global responsibility, and every person in every nation has a responsibility to take part in the in planning, okay? And in altering as much as possible use and consumption patterns. But I'm talking to Americans, so, or Canadians. Are there any Canadians? No?
I mean, I guess the bigger question is, how do justice issues affect this machine called the interdependent global capitalist economy? And I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. It would be nice if justice issues influenced the allocation of resources. But the bigger question, the more important issue, is how do justice issues influence the allocation of scarce resources in this economy that basically responds to price signals, supply, demand, and so forth?
I'll get to that a little bit in a bit. So not as much as you want. I'll promise it's not as much as you want, but I will talk about that.
I think you're preaching to the choir here.
Okay. All right. But it helps to have some facts, okay? Because facts, at least for me, are always prophetic. Right. In other words, they make me sit up and take note. This is grain cultivated area per person. 1950, it was up above 0.2 hectares. A hectare is about 2.5 acres. Okay. And by 2050, we'll be down below 0.1 hectare. So this shows that we need to be careful about how we use grain and how we plant it also. One of the important things to realize is that we are about at saturation on our green revolution. Why is this? This is for biological reasons. You can breed grain so that it puts more energy into forming its head. But after a while, there's kind of a peak there. After a while, it's no longer useful to do that, because if it puts too much energy into forming a head, it won't have enough leaves to feed the head. Okay? And we've reached almost that peak. Okay, the most productive plants that we can make. So that part of it we cannot rely on anymore, being able as a fix. All right. I also wanted to show you something on materials use. This is just a growth in how much our consumption has grown since 1900 as a nation. Now this isn't per person, but this is just nationally. Okay, minerals a 29-fold increase, wood products 3-fold, metals 14-fold, synthetics 82-fold. But what are most of them made of?
Petroleum,
right? And all materials together is an 18-fold increase in use in the U.S. And we haven't had an 18-fold growth in population. So this again is an indication of our accelerating consumption. Have any of you been up by the basketball court? What else is up there?
Junk pile.
An enormous junk pile. Now we all know that Holden is a place where fixing things is a priority rather than just tossing them and replacing them. Partly because it's so expensive to get things here and to get rid of the old ones. But That is a junk pile that's accumulated over the last 4 or 5 years, waiting to grow to a large enough size that it can be taken to a scrap dealer. If a community that supports 450 people in the summer, but only about 80 the rest of the year, can produce a scrap pile like that, imagine what is happening in our more disposable society. Our refrigerators, when we get new ones, don't just sort of sit out in our backyards. You know, we don't see them go, so we don't realize how much we're using up, but we are. Okay. War is another place where we expend a lot of resources. In this century, per 1,000 people who've lived, okay, 44 people have been killed in war. That's nearing on 5%. Okay? Nearly 5% of our populations have died in war in this century. Okay? In 1996 dollars, World War II cost us $5.5 trillion. Okay? And in that war also, 60% of the victims were civilians. So we're talking about a loss of incredible amounts of money going to a war effort. We're talking about an incredible death toll, much of it civilian. And not only that, but in 1943, 35% of our working people were either in the army or producing munitions. And if you think that's high, the Soviet Union was 54%, over half, okay? So this is another place where we are expending ourselves, expending our energy, and expending our money. If we could funnel more of that money into other areas, it would be easier to redistribute income, to do the things that we need to do to encourage people to consume less and to produce in less harmful ways. So this is a very complicated question because, of course, even in peacetime, we employ all kinds of people in clean munitions work, and they have good jobs, and they can use their technical skills. But it still remains that if they could use those for other purposes, there would be some constructive work going on that isn't now. This is not meant to make us feel hopeless, but it's meant to help us understand the gravity of the problem. Many of us already do, but it helps to look at it every so often to realize how important it is. Now, how does Christian thinking come in here? This week we've been talking about dualist understandings of the world, especially the division between spirit and matter, or humanity and nature. And how, when you do that, you're opposing one thing to another and making one of them better and the other worse. Humanity is better than nature, spirit's better than matter, men are better than women, etc. Okay. From our traditional Christian theological framework, we have usually divided things dualistically in this way. And that meant that humanity was on the God side of the equation most of the time, right? And the rest of nature was on the other side, this divide. Okay. Well, if we take an ecological perspective, a creation-centered perspective, we are part of creation, right? Now, for most of the week, we've been talking about how that means that creation deserves our respect. Creation has intrinsic value, okay? Creation may be much more of God's effort and interest than we are in some ways when you look at the span of time that it takes for it to come into being. But it also tells us something else. If creation has inherent value, all of creation, then we have inherent value. If bears, cougars, termites, and bacteria have some sort of right to exist or intrinsic value, so do we. So, it means that there is nothing wrong with taking care of ourselves. What is wrong with taking care of ourselves is that we sometimes do it in a way that jeopardizes others to an inappropriate degree. So we can see a creation-centered theology as one that helps us to respect the inherent value of what's around us, but one that also helps us to respect our own inherent value, okay? To give ourselves some rights and some responsibilities. I say responsibilities because, as we were mentioning the other, we mentioned the other day that what happens when a deer population grows too large, for instance? We were talking about this.
They starve,
right?
You shoot them.
Right? Or if we don't wait for them to starve, we shoot them, right? Naturally, what happens is that they starve or they get weakened and killed by other animals, right? And so the population eventually is self-limiting. If we want to kill them off before they kill our trees, right, we shoot them. However, deer don't look around themselves and say, there are too many of us. Maybe we shouldn't make so many, right? They don't have that ability. We have the ability to look around ourselves and say, there are too many of us. Maybe we shouldn't make so many. And we also have the ability to look around ourselves and say, when I eat a lot of beef, that's really pretty bad for the environment. Maybe I shouldn't eat so much. Maybe I should eat beans more often. We have the ability to change our way of living, and so that we don't necessarily have to wait for ourselves to die off. Because we will die off very quickly if we continue doing what we're doing right now. So we have the choice of doing this voluntarily or having it happen to us. And I'm of the frame of mind that thinks it might be a nice idea to do it voluntarily. And that's partly because from a Christian perspective, we need to be concerned about our brothers and sisters and their welfare. it's very difficult to consider people expendable. It's sometimes possible to consider animals and self-limiting populations expendable, but it's harder to consider our brothers and sisters in that way. Okay. What I want to discuss now is the Earth Charter, and then I want to discuss some ways in which people are already trying, through taxation systems, etc., to use government to change the way that that a capitalist society operates. I am not giving you the whole text of the Earth Charter simply because it was a lot of pages. I'm going to give you the brief version.
I have this to you.
Oh, yay. Thank you. Okay. The Earth Charter is part of a two-pronged effort. I'm trying to think if I should turn on the lights more. I'm going to use this again in a few minutes, so I guess I won't. It's part of a two-pronged effort, which has grown out of some United Nations initiatives. It got its first beginnings, and this tells you how long these things take to happen. At the United Nations Stockholm Conference on Human Environment, and that was in 1972. Okay? People began to think it would be a good idea to write a document containing principles for the development of a sustainable society internationally. And they hoped to have a full document ready at the end of the Rio Conference in 1992, but there was so much disagreement over the wording of it that it did not happen. Since then, the Earth Council and Green Cross International, with the sponsorship of the Dutch government, have been working on a new document. And this involves people from all over the world. One of the key players has been Stephen Rockefeller, who I think is in the Department of Philosophy at Middlebury. Does anybody know? I think that's right. He's been really instrumental in pulling people together. Larry Rasmussen, whom some of you know from Union Seminary, who's done a lot of environmental writing, has been involved in this. People from international backgrounds, and they have written a draft, a couple or three drafts of this, and the drafts are now circulating internationally, partly as a way of getting people on board and partly as a way of trying to work through the language. The general principles, which you have before you, are fairly benign. In fact, they seem so mushy and vague that they could be not worth anything. But I encourage you to go to the website when you get home, which is listed on here, because it gives the details for each principle, some of which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But there are sub-principles for each of these, which give a few more details. There are still some objections out there. Our government, which is the only government, the only legitimate government, not to have endorsed the United Nations document on the rights of children, is also one of the governments that's going through this with a magnifying glass, trying to find things that will wound it, and is anxious about it. Also, the Roman Catholic Church is very worried about it, because whenever you start talking about population, they read into that abortion and sterilization, even though the language of the document is very carefully done to avoid that kind of implication. So there are ways that you can respond to this, that you can promote this in your own communities. It would be great fodder for an adult ed discussion, probably, in your local congregations. And so I encourage you to go and get the full draft of this when you get home, or you're welcome to look at mine. I also would like to say that it may sound very idealistic to have this charter. Oh, we all believe in these things. Now, let's all do them. Well, the people who are writing this realize it, and so there's a second commission which is working on another document called, what is it called? I know what it is. It's a legal charter that holds nations. Okay, right now it's the IUCN Draft International Covenant on Environment and Development, and it is an instrument of international law, or it will be once it's adopted. The hope is to put both of these through the United Nations. Okay, one is the philosophical document, which we're looking at, The other one is a legal document which will actually hold nations to certain kinds of standards with respect to these principles. So it's not all hoping and dreaming.
How could it be enforced?
Well, it could only be enforced in international courts to the limit, I mean, to the extent that international courts can have an effect. Okay? So, and one of the, another reason to read this book is that it has one article that deals with the international legal system, the problems that exist in it, and maybe ways of fixing them, and the strengths of it. And yes, the international courts are not able to put teeth behind everything because teeth requires machinery, and that's hard to commit, especially because a lot of it is our machinery. Anyway, there is an article on that in here, and so I recommend that to you as well.
I don't think anyone believes the United States is going to come anywhere close to fulfilling its pledges on emissions of CO2 that it agreed to at the last Rio conference.
This is a problem.
It's easy for politicians to say, oh, yeah, I believe in that. I had a conversation with John Marty the other day, and he said, when you talk to everyone in the Minnesota State Legislature, they'll all say, oh, I believe the campaign finance system is terrible. And yet, you know, after they'll give a speech about the evils of campaign finance reform, they'll walk to their offices and dial their contributors for more money. You know, it's like, I think that one of the things the Bible tells us is the real strong power that sin has, the grip that it has on us as individuals and on whole societies.
Well, since you're bringing this up again, let me just, I'll talk about the Charter in a minute, but let me show you these now. There have been places in which people are using, I'll go backwards, one of the perhaps the only beauty of the capitalist system was that it was designed to harness people's self-interest for the communal good. Now, I don't pretend to say that it really works now, but the beauty of it was that it took our weakest point, which was our greed, and thought that we could harness this to make life better for everyone. Okay, it didn't necessarily work the way it was supposed to, or it's broken down a little bit in the way that it's supposed to work, but we can still take advantage of this to a degree if we can get the legislation through. For instance, revenue shifting is important, an important idea. I was talking with someone from Minnesota, by the way, the other day, who said that there's a proposal in Minnesota to tax cars not according to their cost when you buy them, right? But according to things like weight, engine size, and fuel usage. And the more of the higher you are on those scales, the more tax you'll have to pay if you buy when you buy a car. Rather than saying, well, if you buy a $2,000 car, it's only, you know, $80, and if you buy, et cetera, okay? There are some experiences on the books, and you know, this is a very small table because there aren't a lot of them to document yet. But if you look at these, there are some effects. We would probably want to see more, but there's some effect. The toxic waste tax in Germany, a drop of 15% in 3 years. Wow, just taxing toxic waste. Water pollution taxes in the Netherlands, that goes back to 1970. Maybe as much as a 99% drop in industrial discharges of heavy metals attributable to that tax. I mean, there are other factors in each of these drops, but the part attributable to the tax is from the water pollution tax. Okay. The sulfur oxide tax in Sweden, what is that, about a 12 or 13% drop? Okay. The ozone depletion tax in the United States helped phase outs go faster, and the Norway's carbon dioxide tax, that doesn't have a huge effect, but at least a small one. We need to see much larger effects. So these are little baby steps toward using greed to the common good. Now, this is actual revenue shifting, and the results of it aren't in yet, and you can see that not much revenue is being shifted, but if we could shift a lot more in this way, it would have a great effect. Notice that most of this is coming out of personal income and wages and going toward resource uses, okay? Carbon and sulfur emissions, petroleum, natural gas and electricity, landfilling, okay? If we can shift taxes from what we're earning to the degree to which we're disrupting the environment, the more you disrupt it, the more you have to pay, right? We might be able to have an effect too. I don't know about you, how many of you travel in Canada ever by car? Okay, what's the first thing you do before you cross the border? You fill up your tank, because gas is phenomenally expensive in Canada. It costs just about as much per liter in Canada as it costs in the United States per gallon, I think. That may be Canadian money. Is that about right?
It's almost par now.
Yeah.
Because of the Canadian dollar being weakened.
Right.
Par increased in price, so it's almost the same cost now.
Okay, all right. But in the recent past, it hasn't been. And isn't it amazing what it might do to you if you lived in Canada? You might drive less, okay? If we could tax gas and use the money instead of to rebuild highways, to rebuild our transportation systems, there are things that we can do that do lower our usage of these resources and use our pocketbooks in order to do that, so that it doesn't have to be just our goodwill. But the problem is that we need people like John Marty who are willing to stick their heads out on the chopping block and try to get these things going, right? The point here is also that we need to be activists if we want to see these things happen. It's hard to be an activist on a national scale. It's hard enough to be an activist on a local scale. Some things that my husband and I have been involved in the last year have taught us that. But we need to do it, because otherwise we need to get the legislation through in order to have tax shifting like this. So those are a couple of signs of hope that are models for a much larger scale effort that we would need to make in this way. Any comments or experiences with any of you work with those kinds of issues locally or in your states and have things to share about those? No? Okay.
Well,
yeah, we do. Okay, tell away.
In the state of Washington, there's an initiative which is to lower the automobile tax that you pay on your license.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and this is going to take away from public transportation, probably. Yeah. And so we'll probably have a real shift in revenue, but probably the opposite way.
And this is happening more and more as people are saying, let's take money out of the hands of the government. They lower one tax, but they don't raise another, right? And they don't do those infrastructure improvements that are needed. Yeah.
I happen to agree with you about the importance of taxes. Just as one example, if we did tax petroleum, gasoline in our cars to the extent of many European countries and Japan, we could probably eliminate the income tax. There's just so much revenue there to be had.
Right.
Then there's the other issue. You know, you were expressing your concern for the poor, and one of the problems with taxation of a lot of consumer goods is that the weight often does fall on the poor, and so there is that unfortunate side effect.
Right.
You know, that a lot of things environmentalists would like to do make, like for example, have to reduce the amount of abuse of animals in the food production industry by letting them run freely on, you know, free-range animals, things like that. Well, that's going to raise the cost of meat, which is going to affect the poor.
Right.
You know, so there's often this trade-off between doing the right thing for the environment and for animals, and the impacts on the higher cost that must be carried by all of us, but for most particularly the poor who need to eat.
There's another problem with that. I'm not going to get the figures right because I didn't write it down. But in this year's State of the World, there's a nice article on urban planning, And this is incredibly important when we're talking about poverty, okay? Because you need to have people living near their services and their jobs. And one of the main problems in our larger decaying cities is that they don't. I think that it said that 81% of people were within walking distance of public transportation in cities, but that only 35% of jobs are. So we have in Chicago, for instance, new companies springing up that are not only sort of temp agencies, but bus people to the suburbs to work, okay? And we have, the problem is that people can't afford to live in the suburbs where the jobs are. And the jobs aren't very well paying anyway. So the people in the suburbs are commuting downtown, and the people from the city are commuting out to the suburbs to do service industry and factory work. It's just a ridiculous waste. It's kind of like, I don't know if you have this experience. We live miles, hundreds of miles from all of our family. And at Christmas, we're always sending piles of stuff across the country, and they're sending piles of stuff to us. And I'm thinking, this doesn't make sense. Why don't we just keep the pile here? The same thing with workers and jobs. Okay, our cities and our suburbs are not set up so that you can use them without a car. Has anyone ever lived in Europe for any length of time? When I was 12, my father had a sabbatical, and we spent only 6 weeks of it living in this little town on the coast of Italy. We lived above a restaurant. And when we went out to do the shopping, we would take our little wheel cart and walk around the neighborhood and come back. If we wanted to go to the beach, we walked over to the beach. We didn't have to get in our car unless we wanted to go to another town. Our cities and our suburbs are not set up this way, and urban planning, believe it or not, is one of the most important ways to make sure the poor don't suffer here, because we need to make sure that they can get to things without cars. The other thing we don't have, we've only recently gotten in the United States, and we could beef up, is a negative income tax. That is, that there are some people who not only don't pay taxes, but get money. Right, extra money on top of their regular incomes. And they have to be doing that not at the end of the year, but along the way. It doesn't do you any good if you earn $10,000 a year to wait for your $3,000 check in April, right? What you need is a negative income tax that provides people that income along the way, along with their regular wages, so that we can help to counteract some of the harm that's going to come to poor people from taxing things like beef or oil or whatever it is we're going to tax in order to encourage people to use it less.
There actually is a negative tax like that in the U.S.
There is, right, the earned income credit,
yeah.
Right? But we could do more with that.
Yeah.
If we were going to raise taxes on oil, et cetera, we could also beef up the earned income credit, and it probably would have to go together in order to avoid the kind of injustice that you're talking about. Interdependence is true politically and economically, not only ecologically, right? And when you tinker with the system, you have to be careful. Any other comments or experiences with these things? It sounded like you had a story you wanted to tell. Or maybe you don't want to tell it.
I can't think of what it was now. It's gone away.
Okay.
Well,
yes.
The big problem of public transportation in a city like Seattle is that only 10 or 15% of the commuters actually commute downtown by any means.
Right.
And all this transportation is set up to serve them.
Yeah.
And people that work outside of the city are pretty much out of luck.
Right.
When I worked for Boeing, it would have taken me 2 hours longer to commute by bus than by car.
In Chicago, it's very often true that you have to go into the center of the city and then out again.
That's what we do. Mm-hmm.
And it's very complicated to do, mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a famous relationship and now the name escapes me of who invented that. It was the guy who was Paul Ehrlich, mm-hmm. The zero population growth guy, I think is the one who came up with it. It's impact I equals P population times T technology times C consumption.
That's great.
Basically. And I think you addressed the consumption part of that equation.
Impact I
I equals P times T times C.
That's still not very clear, is it?
Okay. And I thought you addressed very well the C part of the equation. There's the T part of the equation, which is our whole technology base, which is also consuming and producing, consuming resources and producing lots of toxics and so forth. And then there's the P part of the equation, which we hardly touched on at all, which is population, which I think is maybe the biggest, most immediate threat because it's growing so rapidly.
Right.
The population doubling time is in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 years. So we have right now about, what is it, 6 or 7 billion on the planet. Possibly in our lifetimes, at least the younger folks among us, it may be up to anywhere from 11 to 15 billion people. And that is a serious, serious problem because then you've got P times multiple, you know, you've got all these people needing consumer goods from an industrial base that's producing, consumes more resources, produce more toxics, okay? And it's you know, going to be a real problem. So I guess I think a thing, something that religious people need to address also, in addition to their consumption, is their proclivities to increase population. And
yes,
what can we do as religious people? Right now, I think what religious organized religion has done is basically be a stick in the mud and a barrier and you know, preventing people from really trying to do anything about that. And so how can we turn that around, I guess?
Yes, you're right. For Americans, this is the smallest of the difficulties because our rate of reproduction, although it might be higher than it should be, compared to the rest of the world, isn't bad, okay? Average birth rate per woman is 2.
Okay. Yeah, but those two are equal to 6 in India. That's the problem.
Yes, and
so every time we don't have another child, we've reduced our problem by 6. I mean, if we're comparing.
Right, and because we use so much more than everybody else.
Right.
Because the impact of one American child is phenomenally greater than the impact of a child elsewhere in the world. Now, what are some ways, what are some tried and true ways of reducing birth rates?
Educate women.
Yes.
That's one of the most important ones, okay? It is absolutely the case that the more education women have, the fewer kids they have, okay? Now, I'm not talking about this in a utilitarian way because one of the points is that we need to treat men and women equally, that we need to educate women for their own sakes, all right? But it happens to be the case that when we educate women, they don't have as many kids.
And empower them economically.
And you empower them economically. Yeah, both.
Well, often that also means educating men.
It often means educating men, but it's all—it's virtually never the case that women are more educated than men.
Right, but there you talk about areas of the world where neither men nor women
right.
are educated.
Yeah.
True.
Right.
And so if you're not going to just educate the women in the population, you're going to have to educate both men and women.
There's no, but it's very unlikely that there are many parts of the world where you wouldn't educate the men if you were also educating the women. But you need to educate men and women, both. Education is extremely important here. The other thing that's important is medical care, good medical care, because one incredibly important motivating factor for having more children is not being sure they're going to live. The other thing is that we've got to remember that in the United States, we're a consumer society. In a consumer society, children are a liability. When you have if you have another child, people say, oh my gosh, how are you going to pay for college? You know, how can you pay for piano lessons? How can you pay for teeth being straightened? You know, children are a liability. We don't look at our children and think those are our investment for security in our old age.
Right.
No, we don't at all. In fact, they're worried that we're going to burden them when we get old, okay? In the developing world, children are still seen as economic assets. Okay? As long as children are seen as economic assets, how on earth can you convince people they shouldn't have them? Okay? So it is an economic problem, it is a medical problem, it is an educational problem. You can't simply say to people, don't have kids, because that doesn't make sense. What makes sense is having children. It makes sense to us not to have children because they're expensive, but it's not the case for the rest of the world. Okay? So you're perfectly correct that population is important. But as Americans, our enormous downfalls are technology and consumption. But we do need to work to make the world a place where population is not such a temptation for other people.
But going back to our religious roots, we are taught throughout the Old Testament anyway, I don't know about the New, but the Old Testament says, be fruitful and multiply. I mean, we are taught that children are God's gift. And we should not stand in the way of God and procreation. Where is there any religious basis in our whole faith tradition for limiting population?
The rest of the sentence is, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, we've already done that. Furthermore, that commandment was given first to the animals before humans were even on the scene in the Genesis 1 or 2, I'm not sure.
That's a very helpful way of reading that. I like that very much. The other thing is that, and this is a more process theological way of looking at it. Guess what? We can't find answers to all questions in the Bible because the Bible couldn't anticipate all questions. The Bible does talk about not overusing the land. It does talk about justice to other human beings.
Jubilee.
Right? I think we can interpret population control as an element of this. Frankly, we don't need to go at population control as an end in itself, because all of the aids that reduce population are things that people deserve as basic rights anyway. They deserve education, they deserve adequate medical care, they deserve an economy in which it's possible to make a living, okay? And if you look at all of those things, they'll reduce population growth. Certainly, we have one real obstacle here. It's a very large institutional obstacle. And I say this as a Roman Catholic. It's the Roman Catholic Church. Because Roman Catholics have not yet learned to see that things like natural family planning, all right, are interventions in reproduction and are not really morally any different than barrier methods, are not really morally any different than sterilization. Because if a miracle can happen during natural family planning, a miracle can happen certainly when you're on the pill or using a diaphragm or have undergone sterilization. If it really is the case that God wants to give you a child, God can do that no matter what method you're using. And now I'm speaking as myself, okay?
I think Roman Catholics have learned it for the most part. It's only at the higher level.
Right. Roman Catholics have learned it. If you look at any stats on use of contraception by Roman Catholic women, you will see that in fact. But the problem is that the spokespeople that, I'll go so far as to say, disrupt documents on population, on economics, on environment, okay, are the hierarchs.
Celibate right. Males.
Well, yes, by definition, all right? They are the ones who disrupt these.
They're not all celibate.
Well, true.
Cardinal of San Francisco is a big scandal now.
Right.
Bishop or whatever.
I was baptized by someone who later turned out to have children, so I know about this. Anyway, the point is that it's the hierarchs who can disrupt these things, and they do. And so the Roman Catholic populace has a responsibility to keep working on their hierarchs. But they manage to throw more weight than they represent.
Well, we should be working on our political system too, because we don't need any more of what Ronald Reagan did in Mexico in 1980. He stopped our very well-planned out organization to help people plan their families. All over the world we were doing that. And he stopped it cold. And now it's still hanging around.
Yeah.
We still have things like if you, well, I guess it's abortion for people in the military. If a woman is pregnant in the military, then they won't pay for it. It's not a health issue. Mm-hmm.
This is my own feeling. I think we can come at this and almost ignore abortion if we. In terms of global policy, if we're looking at other issues. But the problem is that until we repair our ways of relating to each other, pregnancy, an unwanted pregnancy is going to be a problem. And it's going to victimize women who should not have to bear it. So, but that's a kind of a result of human sin, not sort of an accident. It's fascinating. If you want to look under principle number 8, I've got the details here. You don't have the details, you just have the vague general language. But the 6th sub-principle there is provide universal access to health care that fosters reproductive health and responsible reproduction. As mildly worded as that is, and it's not on your sheet, okay? As mildly worded as that is, it is a point of contention. Because everybody's reading sterilization and abortion right in there.
Yeah.
Even though it need not be.
Now that is one way that it's been done, and that's what's scary.
It is.
And I think a lot of things have happened in China that are really, really scary, but sometimes some of those things haven't happened too. The people that we talk to in China, the educated people, want one child because they know they have a population problem.
Right.
And they only want one, but they are the educated university people.
Right. Yes.
Is the solution, I mean, I'm almost afraid to even mention this, but is the solution to turn up all the countries of the world into consumer societies so they'll see children as
Everybody hopes that you don't have to pass through our stage in order to get to the other side. How many Marxists are in the room? If you're a Marxist, you probably aren't too hopeful about all this. I hope we don't have to believe in Marx and Engels in order to get to a more sustainable environment, economy. But I don't have a crystal ball.
The alternative is where we all voluntarily simplify our lives, which would probably be very spiritually beneficial, and take the social surplus that would be liberated thereby and redistribute it to in such a way that the rest of the world's people can get the education they need, can begin to participate in a global renewal towards a higher level of global understanding of how we're all interconnected, and thereby move toward, as we're trying to move toward, a more sustainable society. But that will involve huge transfers of wealth from the developed to the developing world to make that education possible, to make medical care possible, to make all of these things possible. And I, you know, in a consumer society such as we have today, the very thought of that, I think, to the average person who loves driving in their sport utility vehicle every day, it's going to be really require the kind of transformation of attitudes, not just in this country, but in Europe and Japan and elsewhere.
Yeah.
We're talking about a transformation that is probably will only happen through necessity and not through choice.
There's a lot in what you say, but the sooner that we can get some of these revenue transfers in place, the more quickly we can lean people toward new habits, including ourselves. Okay, I do not exclude myself here. All right. And the busier you are and the less income you have, the harder it is to make yourself behave in an ecologically responsible way.
Right.
Lack of time and lack of money are the two greatest barriers here. And they're even hard for in this kind of a society to surmount. So I think we should probably stop there. But I encourage you, the summary principles that you have on your sheets are vague, namby-pamby, etc. I encourage you to look at the full document because some of these are hammered out in a very difficult, clear language. What I would like to point out when you're looking at this, though, is for you to realize that the authors of the charter are trying to be very sensitive to the fact that in every geographic area, the emphases that we must give these principles and the ways that we go about fulfilling them are going to be different. Okay? Local action has to be fitted to the local environment, both politically and ecologically. So be aware of that as you're looking at these. This isn't saying that everybody has to do everything the same way.
Think globally, act locally.
Yep. And for instance, in every country, which of these three factors are going to be emphasized is going to be different. And which takes a lesser role. So thanks for coming. Do visit this website or write to the Earth Charter Organization to find out where the process is going, what you can do to be of use. Because it's clear that if we're going to get this into the UN and out of the UN, there's going to have to be public support for it. We haven't been able to get the document on children's rights through our Senate. The President won't even give it to the Senate yet. It's been hanging around out there for 4 or 5 years, not submitted to the Senate. If we want action on these things, we're going to have to press for it. So thanks for being here, and good luck in your labors.